Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings, Ken Woodward here. And let me tell you, it is good to be here. It has been a long time coming, and it's good to be delivering a relaunched Curated Questions episode to your receptive ears. Together, we will engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I'm a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey as I work to hone my questioning skills, and I'm glad you are here. Our conversation partner today is Lynn Borton. Lynn is the creator and host of the podcast and Pacifica radio show, Choose to be Curious. Lynn is a facilitator of conversations and transformation, with more than 30 years of experience in strategic governance and change management in the nonprofit sector. Combining science, organizational learning, and leadership development, Lynn is working to synthesize the study of curiosity into something that we can all appreciate, an exciting path to greater personal well-being, professional success, and life satisfaction. For nearly 25 years, Lynn worked at NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization, and served as the chief operating officer for her final 12 years. What started as a curious investigation into a startup radio station in Arlington, Virginia, developed into a weekly show with guests from across the globe and over 200 episodes. Lynn, welcome to Curated Questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken. I am really delighted to be here. I think we're going to have some fun.
I'm certain that's going to be the case. So if we jump in the Wayback Machine,
yeah.
Were curiosity and questions a part of your childhood? And how did that look?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. Very much so. I guess I was fortunate in this respect. I really had parents who believed in the power of questions and encouraged curiosity. And I don't have a personal memory of this, but the story is told in the family lore that when I was maybe 3 or 4 years old, my parents sat down to watch Hamlet on television. And I insisted that I wanted to watch it with them. And they thought, well, she'll just fall asleep and it'll be fine. Apparently, that's not what happened. Apparently, what did happen was that I peppered them with questions throughout the entire production. And according to them, I had really a very good grasp of this play by the end, and I stayed awake for the entire thing. And the next morning, my dad kind of checked in to see whether I had really understood it. And I said, well, I'm sad. And he said, well, why are you sad? And I said, well, I'm just really sad because Hamlet didn't have any friends. And I began to recount the story, which was something I could do only because I had asked a lot of questions. And I don't remember this incident, but I feel really confident that it's a really good example of the kind of soup, the culture in which I was raised, that not just tolerated, but really encouraged and rewarded that kind of curiosity from the very start.
And to your point, your parents were just very encouraging, or as you say, setting the climate. That was just a family culture of...
Yeah, I mean, both my parents are educators. So I think the mindset was there already in terms of how do you help kids learn? Well, you help kids learn by tapping into their curiosity and answering their questions and encouraging them to have more questions and rewarding them for having those questions and modeling having your own questions and answering those questions and all that kind of good stuff. I have a brother who's about a year and a half younger, so he was probably asleep in the bassinet someplace else at the time. But I think it was a very intentional thing on my parents' part, and they were very intentional as well in terms of the places that they chose to live, in terms of opening our eyes to the world. And I'm really grateful for that because not everybody has that.
Wow, that's fantastic. Then when did you really first understand the power of questions?
Well, at some level, I feel like I internalized it really early on. When you issued this invitation, lovely invitation, thank you again, I started to think about sort of that question. And I, one of the incidents that came to mind was actually when I was in high school. And my parents actually went through a rough time in their marriage, and they were separated for a bunch of years when I was in high school. And it was not a very fun time in any of our lives. And there was one weekend that was particularly not fun. And I came back to school and I turned in my physics lab. I had to do whatever the homework was. And the teacher came to me and she said, Lynn, like, this is a mess. Like, what's going on? And I burst into tears. And it was maybe one of the first times where I really understood the power of a question that came from care. And that a well-timed question could uncork a lot of stuff that nobody knew was there. And nobody knew that the stuff was going on in our household. It was not something I talked about. But a question that had nothing to do with the problem at hand turned out to be the secret key to opening up something I desperately needed to talk about.
Wow. That's fantastic. And it is, it's just a very simple question.
Right.
Right? It's just
they don't get much more simple.
And I spend lots of time trying to think about and craft the perfect question. And the reality is that there's a place for that, but there's also just a place of the basic question backed by, as you experience that care,
right,
of just really, because a common thing as I'm walking down the halls at work, or I've actually given up on when people go, how you doing?
It's not a question.
Exactly. It's an acknowledgement of your existence.
Maybe.
Right. So I've shifted to good to see you. So I'll walk down the hall and I just say, good to see you. And most of the time, somebody will say, good.
Right.
Because they're expecting me to say, how you doing?
Right.
And just, it's that passing thing. So you do ask the question, how are you? And you give it that pause because it's in, and if you really mean it, it really can be earth-shattering. And to the point of that, what's going on?
Right.
That is a basic question that we say and hear every day. But is it backed with the, I really do want to hear the answer, and I'm here to sit with you? I legitimately want to know. That can be powerful.
Yeah. And I give credit actually to Scott Nickum, who's somebody that I've interviewed on my show about this idea of asking questions out of care. He's the one who gave it that language for me many years ago. And I really have embraced and come to appreciate just exactly how profound that is and how intuitively we know the difference, even if we don't name it, and how influential our assessment of it is in our willingness to provide anything remotely like a genuine answer to a question like that. Because most of us do experience it as a very, like, not a question, as a kind of a transactional, you know, sky's blue, how are you? And when it's asked with genuine care, it's really a lovely question.
Absolutely. And as we shift to the middle spot in your life, as you're working at NAMI, is that how you pronounce it?
I pronounce it NAMI.
NAMI.
Okay. It goes by both.
Okay.
People will recognize it either way, probably.
Okay. So can you talk through a little bit about what their focus is? Because I saw it, mental illness, but I'm like, if you've got a better understanding of it.
So NAMI is, well, it was founded by the parents of mostly young adults with psychotic illnesses in the, like, in the 1970s. And at the time, there was very little effective treatment or much hope for people in those circumstances. And families were blamed for the illnesses, and deinstitutionalization had started, but the promised safety net that was supposed to come with it never materialized. And so people found themselves and their lives in just complete chaos. And I had, coming out of college, worked in a psychiatric hospital in Boston. It was my domestic equivalent of the Peace Corps. It really felt like I was working in a third world country. I mean, it was just appalling, the conditions that people were living in and the stretch that it required for me to get my hands around what that meant. So when I left that job and came to DC, I was looking at a bunch of different stuff, and mental health struck me as one of the next civil rights frontiers. It seemed like a social justice question. And so I thought, I'm going to go towards that. So I found NAMI and stayed involved with NAMI for a very, very long time. And over time, its focus and its position in the conversation changed. When I first got there, they were pretty fringe, actually. It was small, new, looked on with a fair amount of skepticism. You know, fast forward a bunch of years, changes in medication, changes in our understanding of brain science, changes in our understanding of human development. And NAMI was big and really a force to be reckoned with. And I think part of the reason that we think about mental illness differently now. So that was a really exciting place to be. And I wore many, many hats over my years in and out of the organization. Right. And ultimately, as you mentioned, I was the chief operating officer. And it was literally my job to know everything for this organization. And I oversaw all of the field operations and governance and everything else. But I came to realize that I was better at my job if I didn't know everything and I was curious instead. And that was the impetus for becoming a student of curiosity, that if I could let go of this expectation that I had and everybody else around me had, that I would know the facts and I would have answers and I would be the wise one in the room, and instead looked for the wisdom elsewhere, it would just go better. And it did. And I really came to appreciate that. So then that led me to wanting to be a real student of curiosity. And fast forward to the next phase of life, that led to the radio show.
Gotcha. Now, that curiosity or understanding, mm-hmm. was that during that last 12 years where you were the chief operating officer, or did that happen earlier?
Well, certainly the intentional, the really focused, intentional kind of student of curiosity was very much in that last phase. But I feel like it's baked in. I think it's in the DNA. I feel like it was, and my guests say this with some frequency, I never really thought about it until you asked, right? It wasn't until I started to ask myself this question and learn more about how curiosity works and what we might be able to do with it, that I could, in retrospect and with reflection, sort of see all of the places that it had shown up in my own life and where I had been using it or elevating it in ways that I wouldn't necessarily have described that way at the time, but feel, again, in retrospect, like, oh yeah, that's all part of the chain of pearls on this thing.
Right. Yeah, that, as I was describing to someone the other day, it's, I think a lot of the just questions in general are one of the things where it's, oh, it's in, we are swimming in water and don't realize we're swimming in water. They're all around us. And now it's just shining a light on it and being intentional about it. And then it's, oh yeah, this is happening. Let's go ahead and just pay attention. And now let me, with that intentionality, let me go start using them strategically as a tool.
Yeah. Yeah. You say swimming in water and not even recognizing it. Are you familiar with the children's book, The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Jester?
Yes. Okay. I actually listened to it not too long ago, or within the last year, on audiobook.
It is, without question, my favorite book of all time for many, many reasons. But one of the reasons is that there's a scene, which you may or may not remember, where they jump to the island of conclusions, because they jump to conclusions. And so this book is full of these puns and making the puns into real things. So they're suddenly catapulted to this island. And to get back from the island, they have to swim through the sea of knowledge. But they get back, they swim and they swim and they swim and they swim. And one of the three travelers is totally dry when he gets to the other side, having spent all this time in the sea of knowledge, because the wetness, the water, the sea of knowledge simply never penetrated. He didn't learn the lesson. Mm. And that was one of many anecdotes from that book, which I loved as a kid and have loved well into adulthood, that I carry with me in terms of, are you absorbing the lessons? Are you getting wet? Are you feeling the water? So
that's beautiful.
So I love that you drew that. I love that you called upon that.
Excellent. I'll have to go back and listen to it again to pick up on some of those things. So that's cool.
Yeah, I love the book.
Now, I want to spend a little bit of time just talking about on the mental health side of things and questions. And because just across the country and the world, mental health can just continues to emerge as a major issue that needs attention. Mm-hmm. What questions do you think we are not asking in the world of mental health? Mm. Or not spending enough time on something like that?
I mean, we can go back to where I started with my high school physics teacher in terms of actually checking in with people about whether or not they're okay. I think we don't do that particularly well. And there are lots of reasons why people don't feel safe acknowledging when they don't feel well or safe or at the top of their mental health game. So I think that's one thing that we could do differently. I think Scott Shigeoka, who has a book that just came out somewhere in the last couple of months called Seek, which is how curiosity can change the world and transform your life, or vice versa. Anyway, it's Seek.
Gotcha. Okay.
And he likes to ask a question about, tell me about a time, or tell me about what makes you come alive, which is a lovely invitation for people to bring forward their most well-grounded self. And I don't know that we're always invited to do that. People ask, how's your work? How's the family? Those aren't necessarily questions that invite us to reflect on what centers and grounds us. And so we don't create opportunities for one another to sit and share and soak in what can make us feel more healthy. And then on the other end, I think there's so much, despite tremendous progress in the field, I think there is still so much stigma associated with mental illness that we don't have good questions for asking about it in the same way that we might ask about other health conditions. I mean, in the old days of NAMI, we used to say that mental illness is not a casserole illness. Like somebody goes to the hospital, nobody shows up at your home with a casserole if somebody's been admitted to a hospital for psychiatric illness in the way that they do heart disease, surgery, whatever. And I think we need to ask ourselves a question about, like, why is that? And what might we do that would change that, so that the conversations about mental illnesses, like any other illness, are actually for real?
Very much. It's a great litmus test, the casserole test,
right?
In that, legitimately, do you even think like that? Is that even a category? I've got some friends that have been going through some very difficult times over the last year, and mental illness has played a role, significant role, and the family is suffering, and many folks just don't know, okay, how do I comfort? I don't know what to say, right? Because I don't want to hurt, all of those things. And just from my experience of doing the things that I'm done, I'm like, I'm more willing to dive in and go, I know I'm going to screw something up. I know this is, I'm going to hurt in some way, but that's not the intention. And we dive into some of the mess anyway. But it's just, there is such a place of loneliness for those that surround the family or the individual, or if there's multiple things going on in the family, it's just brutal.
Yeah.
And there's not any way out. And it's not like, oh, yeah, you have a broken bone and that's going to heal in 6 weeks. Then everything's better after you do some PT.
I think that's one of the downsides, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but I think it's one of the downsides of the kind of wellness, well-being, self-help universe is that we've all internalized this idea that you can fix these things in yourself. And it's just a question of really finding the right combination of things that you believe in. We don't believe that about a broken leg. Great example, right? I broke my ankle a year ago. Nobody thought that I was going to be able to just get up and walk right away after that. People knew she's going to need to sit on the couch for a couple of weeks. And then she's going to be hobbling around. And then it's going to take her a while to rebuild her balance and her strength and her flexibility. If we used that same mindset when it comes to mental illness, we would be a very different culture. We would be a very different place for people who are needing to be on the couch, needing to hobble around, needing to regain balance and strength and flexibility.
That's beautiful. If I think through my conversations and my expectations that I bring to thinking about my friends, that's a helpful insight, is to recognize the stages of healing. And this is after you get to the point that you've made it through whatever milestone marker and say, okay, I'm quote through it. Now comes the healing piece, but it's not as sometimes it's just cut and dry on the mental health piece or mental illness, whereas indeed the bone has not just been set. Right. It's okay, there we're on this journey. That's what it looks like. There's going to be some ebb and flow. And yeah, another friend of mine had complex PTSD and trying to help her navigate some of these things. And just, complex PT has that, or PTSD has that name for a reason, because it's so complex. And to unravel or peel back the onion, it's just so hard. So one piece may be well on its way to healing, but then you have all these other pieces that still have yet to be
used. And as you say, that's the kind of triple whammy of complex PTSD, is that it's complicated and it shows up in places that you don't anticipate and in ways that you can't necessarily, that you can't control, and that can be years and miles removed from their origins. Doesn't make it any less real, doesn't make it any less profound or powerful or disorienting or scary. And I wish I knew what the right questions were to ask. I mean, I think sometimes it's maybe, what do you want me to know? And if people feel comfortable telling you, you can learn a lot by what it is they want you to know about this. I need you to know that this thing is really hard for me. And it's not necessarily a question that people can answer in the heat of the moment. It's a better conversation to have at some other point, like an advanced directive. It's sure. If this happens, what would you like me to know? What would you like me to, how can I be helpful? If this ever happens, how could I be helpful? It's nice to know that people want to be helpful, right? And if you have a sense in advance that somebody's willing to be helpful and has some information about what might actually be helpful, that's like money in the bank.
Yes. And that concept probably goes even beyond just mental health, or that idea of having conversations with close family and say, this is how I see the world. I think that this is what it might look like for me. I've heard folks talk about this world of AI ahead of us. You need to have a safe word such that somebody copies your voice and then plays it back. They put in the words for an AI and say, I'm lost. Right. Send $5,000 right now. Okay, what is our safe word to mean legit or not? How does that look for other topics? I think that it's worth exploring, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. through some journaling, but just to think through, how might that question apply? Where could we apply that in our lives and those around
yeah.
us?
One of the things that was true when I worked at NAMI is that I had many colleagues who were living with mental illness, and I certainly worked with lots and lots of people who lived with mental illness, and those illnesses would come and go, and they might be more disruptive at one time and not so disruptive at another. And there were several people where I'd had that conversation. It's, if this starts to go sideways for you, you know, how can I be helpful? What would you like me to know? What's not going to be helpful? Because that's at least as useful.
Absolutely.
In fact, in some ways, that's more useful information. And I absolutely do not want to set myself up as having always done this or always done it well when I did try.
Sure.
But I was always glad when I had that information. And I was always glad that I had had those conversations when those times came, and they inevitably did.
A conversation in the last couple of months with a coworker who has several disabilities, and it was just so helpful to have an intentional conversation. Mm-hmm. And it was eye-opening that I'm like, oh, okay, just as a result of you existing in your body and who you are, this is what it looks like for you. Mm-hmm. It takes you longer to get ready. It takes you longer to do this or longer to do that. And that's just what life looks like. And I walked away just so grateful for the conversation, because I'm like, that is perspective that in the world of ableism, mm-hmm. I just overlook. Yeah, I've got a healthy body, and some would argue whether I have a healthy mind or not, but there'll be an opinion poll later for that. But in any event, it's the, I hadn't considered that. And how can I be just aware, accommodating, and to your point on the whole sideways thing, and just being aware of that. It's like, oh, okay. It doesn't mean that their capability was any less or anything like that. It's just, okay, this is what life looks like.
Right.
So it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. It's nice to have those opportunities to understand what life looks like, feels like, what its pace is, what it takes to just get from point A to point B when it's not the life that you've been living all this time. We're so accustomed to what we do, we just figure that's what everybody does. But that's...
Yes, absolutely. Cool. All right, let's pivot a little bit to your current project.
Yeah.
So what was the draw to All Things Curiosity?
I mean, it really does go back to the work at NAMI and becoming a student of the subject. And I had speaking of health issues, I had a cancer scare. I ended up having to very quickly delegate off all of my work and reassign everything, and went off and had surgery and had a pretty easy go of it, and was back at work and thinking, all right, dodged a bullet, I'm back. And then I thought, wait, I know people who have not been so fortunate. I need to do something different, and I owe my good fortune something more than the same old. And so my husband and I, we'd just written the last tuition check, and he was almost up on his eligibility for retirement from the federal government. And I'm like, we're just going to do something different. And we both quit our jobs like in the space of a couple of months.
Wow.
And he had a plan. He was going to write a book. My plan was to get a plan. I did not have a plan. But in that last year, totally coincidentally, in that last year, I had been enrolled in a leadership program, and they did at the time a series of lead talks, kind of like TED Talks, but way less intimidating. And I went, I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. This is a goal for me for next year. I'd like to do this. And I thought, well, what am I going to talk about? And I thought, well, I'm getting kind of curious about curiosity. I'll learn stuff and I'll share what I know. I'm not presenting myself as an expert, just a student. Here's what I'm learning, and we'll talk about it. And so that's what I did. I did this talk, and that very day, somebody announced that there was a new non-commercial radio station launching in the community, and they were looking for people to create new content. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I've never done radio. I'm not really sure what that would mean, but I'm a curious person. I'll go find out more. So I did. And then I thought, I want to have more of these conversations. So I pitched a radio show about curiosity. And, one day I got a phone call and they said, you're in. When do you want to get started? And I was like, holy cow, I'm not even fully trained. I don't have anything ready. Give me 6 weeks. Don't let me chicken out. I'll have something for you. And that was May of 2016. And I've been doing it ever since.
That's fantastic. That's cool. Just diving right in and to your point on curiosity. I'll go learn.
I'll go figure it out. And I was like, what's the worst thing that happens? Doesn't turn out to appeal to me, you know? Oh, well, all right, I'll try something else. But when I pitched the show, I made up a list of like 25 topics to sort of test proof of concept. Does this have legs? Can I really come up with a credible number of conversations about this? And I came up with 25 and I thought, okay, there's a good run in this anyway. But it's taking me places I would never have anticipated. And in the meantime, curiosity has gotten very big and it's on every street corner these days. And you open up a lot of major magazines, especially in the business world, and there's all sorts of stuff about curiosity. I didn't see that coming. Certainly wasn't true then, but what's fun for me is to find the conversations about curiosity and work and life that are different than the ones that you get in Harvard Business Review or Fortune Magazine or Inc. or any of the other places that cover curiosity a lot, but in a fairly narrow lens. So to me, that's been the most fun, is surprising myself with what I can come up with.
Yes, and I had a question along those lines where what has been a couple, this is overused now for this conversation, but what have been some curious areas or conversations or directions that this has taken that you absolutely didn't see? And this is not about your favorite, right? This is, okay, what are a couple that come to mind that you're like, yeah, that one caught me for a loop?
Okay, well, one that comes to mind was I did a show on morbid curiosity, which actually is a studied academic field and has some use in terms of being a way for us to test what our reactions might be to disturbing or dangerous kind of situations. And I kept resisting having this conversation because I don't like horror movies. I don't like violent games. I mean, I really am not interested. And so then I kept thinking, you know, if you're resisting it this hard, you probably really do need to have this conversation. That was one of the things that I've learned along the way, is if I'm resistant, I need to go towards it. That's a lesson.
Yes. Beautiful.
And then in this conversation in particular, I realized that there was this really interesting field of study, people doing very thoughtful work that had interesting applications. So there's a woman, I haven't actually interviewed her, but I would like to, who's in Arizona, and she uses the zombie apocalypse as a way to do kind of scenario work with people for urban planning. And a zombie apocalypse is something that people think about and joke about and watch lots of movies and things about. But it actually raises really interesting questions about how would you prepare in terms of the guidance that you would need to provide to your citizens. What are the system infrastructures that would need to be in place? What would your communication systems need to be like? And so the fun for me in that is that being curious in a sort of sideways, kind of funny way ends up being able to inform really serious conversations. So I would guess that was one that sort of really surprised me. But I've also, like next week, I'm interviewing a movie location scout. So I was like, what can we learn from someone whose job it is to observe places very, very closely and to think about how they can be used and how action and mood and the story are advanced by our concept of place and what we see? We haven't had that conversation yet. I don't know what that's going to yield. But to me, that's an interesting place where he may not have thought of this as a curiosity enterprise, but I'm hoping that actually he has some insights into how what he does could teach the rest of us how we think about location, our own work, etc.
I look forward to hearing the conversation. Teaser note for folks, go ahead and check out the podcast and look for this one. But a big fan of the art of noticing.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And being able to just have eyes wide open and be intentional, because once you start looking for one thing, then it certainly broadens the scope of what you notice as you're moving around or moving through the world.
Yeah. When you and I connected on this, and I was thinking about, oh, wow, questions. How exactly have questions come up in my shows? And I'm sure you know of the Right Question Institute, which is an organization that got started up in the Boston area. And they originally got started because they were trying to help parents get more involved in their kids' education. And one of the things that the parents kept coming back to was like, we don't know what questions to ask. Like, we go to the school and we don't really know what to ask. And so they started by helping them, like, crafting lists that they could take with them. And then they were like, actually, the real power is in learning to craft your own questions. And then coming in with a set of questions in hand and getting people to answer those questions. Tremendous power in that. I didn't know that there was such a thing as an institute that focuses on helping people craft the right questions, or a philosopher in the UK who was actually doing this surveying of what is a question? What do we think of that? What makes a question a question? And sometimes we say a sentence that has a question mark at the end, but we don't really mean it as a question. People don't receive it as a question. And other times, there's no question mark. It's not about the punctuation, right? There's a pregnant pause that's full of question. Not a word is spoken. So for me, a lot of what has been surprising and interesting is that the topic is even deeper than I had hoped or expected. And I just feel called to just keep diving down.
Going deep down the rabbit hole.
Go way down all sorts of rabbit holes.
So now, have you had any mentors who modeled curiosity and questions?
People ask me this mentor question a lot, and I don't feel like I have a very good answer. Well, I will say I do think of my parents as mentors in this regard. I really do. I know that sounds a little cliche, but I think it's true. When I was in second grade, my second grade teacher, who went from being Miss Clark to Mrs. Hughes in the middle of the year, had a writing book that we used called Making Things Strange, which was like a creative writing workbook of some sort. But I loved it then, and I appreciate it in hindsight for the emphasis that it placed on observation and getting us to think differently about things. So I don't know if a workbook can be a mentor, but in terms of influences, I would count that. And I will say that my transformation, my evolution around curiosity was very much facilitated by a colleague, somebody who worked for me, but whom I thought of as a mentor in this regard, Valerie Hunter, who works in organizational development and is one of the most gifted people I've ever seen in that field. And we hired her to help folks at NAMI do what they were doing better by being more thoughtful and intentional about how they were creating learning opportunities and how we were communicating and all sorts of things, how we structured meetings. And she was a demanding taskmaster, and I made myself her number one student so that I was not asking anybody to do what I wasn't also making myself do. And there were days where I regretted it because it was a lot of work, holy cow. But I learned so much, so much. And she would say to me, well, get curious, think about this. And I would like roll my eyes. I'm like, I don't need to be curious about this. Like, I know what this is. But she was right. I needed to get curious. I needed to slow down and stop and do that. And I mean, I like to put her in the category of mentor because I think people think that mentors can't be people who are younger or can't be people who work for you. It's always this wise elder, different kind of a relationship. And in my experience, that's absolutely not true.
Fantastic. Now, how or what would be your recommendations for how someone could cultivate curiosity?
I've done, I don't know how many of these shows now. It's so well over 220 at this point. And I ask people how they define curiosity. What do we mean when we're talking about curiosity? I've got at least 200 definitions. Yes. Everybody thinks about it a little bit differently. So that raises the question, what do I think I'm talking about, right? And my sort of working idea of it at this point is that choosing to be curious is acting on the idea that there's opportunity in the unknown. And I think that if you spend a little of each day, a tiny part of each day, thinking that there's opportunity in the unknown, that becomes an invitation to walk down the street you haven't walked down, pick up a book that's in a genre that you wouldn't otherwise read, have a conversation with somebody you wouldn't necessarily have spoken to, pause for a moment longer and look at some architectural detail or figure out what the bird is that you're listening to. I just think the easiest way to bring curiosity into your life is to just pause for a moment and look around and go, what's even the least bit interesting to me around me? And spend a moment with that. And you may decide, okay, that's all I need of that. Or you may think, I have questions. Like, I want to know more. I never thought about this. I never noticed this. What's that made of? How do they do it? Who did that? Where's that coming from? So I ask, one of the things I do in my show is I ask people if they have curiosity practices. What are the ways, large and small, that they bring curiosity into their lives? And people have remarkable insights and ideas. I mean, too many to mention, and it's just a wonderful thing that when we stop and think about it, we realize we do. We have this urge for curiosity. We don't always pay attention to it. We don't always respect it. But if we take that pause, there's a lot of potential there.
I like that point that we often don't respect it.
Yeah.
That resonates deeply. If I reflect back, the times that I have been curious, and what comes most to mind is about people, rarely am I ever not surprised. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, if I'm walking down the street and I see someone, I'm like, I got their number.
Right. We tell ourselves a story right away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And time and time again, I am so wrong. So I'm failing to respect that and give space for that to come to fruition and really understand. And I'm also doing a disservice to me. I'm doing a disservice to the other individual by not just pausing. There is beauty all around. And, you know, with the doom scrolling on social media and the news, if you pay attention to that, beauty does not exist.
Right.
And yet, if we got a little bit curious, and started to pay attention or just give space and respect it. Anthony DeMello says in his book, Awareness, he talks about not telling a child what the name of the bird is, because once you see a sparrow, or once a child sees a sparrow, and the child says, what's that? And you say, it's a sparrow. And the child says, oh, I've now seen all sparrows. Uh-huh. And this is not saying don't teach your kids what birds are, but the idea of, huh, every sparrow is unique. Every person walking down the street is unique. Each one of those row houses that have a small architectural feature is unique. So how can we cultivate appreciation? And I think a lot of that comes through curiosity of trying to learn a little bit more and not believing the first things that the biases would say.
Right. Because we all, myself very much included, we all have these biases baked in. And it's a daily constant vigilance to push back against it. And to understand that that's part of being human, right? I mean, I think, you know,
it's a survival mechanism. Yeah, yes, we need to have it.
But we need to be aware that we have it. And I hear things like what you said about, you know, failing to respect. And I like to think of it as missing the opportunity to respect. Mm. Because it makes it easier for me to recover from a missed opportunity than from a failure. And,
well said.
And I think people need on-ramps. And I feel like that's sort of what you do, is you're helping people find on-ramps. Good questions are on-ramps. I feel like that's what I try to do. It's why I wanted to be on your show, because I think you've built a lot of different on-ramps over the years. And I think that's a really important thing to do.
Thank you. And I am grateful you're here, that's for sure. So what area of your life are you a beginner?
Oh, well, I think of myself as a beginner urban sketcher. This is actually a curiosity practice that I picked up in the last couple of years of taking the sketchbook out and finding something that catches my eye out and about and sitting down in situ and sketching. And I do it in ink, and then I put watercolor into it. And if you know anything about ink or watercolor, there's like no negotiating with them. Once it's down, it's there.
You're done.
It's like it is what it is.
You're committed. Nice.
And I love that about it, because then you just embrace what it was that caught your eye, and you know, worry about whether it was good. It was, the point was to be present in the moment and to create some sort of a record of what you saw. And I was doing that this morning, actually, before I came to sit down with you. And this often happens. Somebody kind of peered over my shoulder and we started chatting. And I think had I just been sitting waiting for a bus or looking as if I was waiting for a friend in this location, that conversation would never have happened. It's like there's something about it that's an invitation. And I don't consider myself very good. I consider myself a beginner. And I keep appreciating it in new ways. And I like the fact that I enjoy it, even though I think of myself as not very good at it.
Why did you pick up sketching? Where did that come from?
I have itchy fingers. Like, I've always wanted to do craft, creative kinds of projects. I do a lot of stuff with textiles. I've always knit, and there was a time in my life where I made a lot of quilts and done all sorts of things. But I was looking for something that was very portable. And I took a class and I thought, this is good. I like this. And then I found this urban sketching movement, which is this international movement of people who do just this, you know, kind of going out and sketching in situ, often in groups. And again, it's not about who's good. It's about all the different ways that we see the world and all the different media we use to capture it and learning from one another and kind of comparing. And it's really a very joyful, communal, creative experience, which turned out to be what I was looking for, even though I didn't know it.
Nice. was that something that you picked up during the pandemic?
Yeah.
Or is it more recent?
Yeah, no, during the pandemic. Like so many other people, where they found a craft, found something that they didn't know was missing from their lives. Right. And that was the beauty of it, right? You don't know what's missing. You don't know how to ask the question. You don't know. You don't even know how to ask the question about like what's the medium, whatever. I'm a big fan of just trying stuff. And some of it, you can be like, okay, once was enough. But sometimes you try something and it's like, oh, this is good. I'm adding this to my life.
Nice. I have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Me too.
Where should someone start as they come to the Choose to Be Curious podcast? Is it just be curious and do the Google random number generator and dive in whatever number it comes up with?
Yeah, or? I mean, I would say kind of scroll through and see what piques your curiosity. Or see what you think, oh, no, I wouldn't be interesting, and go there. To my lesson of sometimes when I'm resistant to something or I think, oh, no, I'm not going to like that, you know, try that out. Maybe it really will be something you don't like, and that would be a bad place for me to tell you to start. But the spirit of the show is that there's opportunity everywhere. And the great human journey is in sort of discovering those opportunities. So, you know, if you want to talk about questions, look at What is a Question with Lenny Watson, the philosopher, or The Right Question Institute with Naomi Campbell, or one that if I were going to send you to your first episode, and I know I missed that boat, thank you already. I would send you to A Double Take on Lynching with historian Susan Strasser and poet Marcia Cole, who are two women who paired up for a double take in all of the meanings of the word on lynching. And it's a really very powerful example of what it means to stop and relook at something with curiosity. And particularly in the context of race in our national history and dialogue. I feel like I try to have something there for anyone. I never know what's going to... There are shows that I think kind of miss the mark. And then I'm surprised because audience members will say, oh my God, I love that episode. Here's what I took away. And to me, if people take one good nugget away from a show, that's a success. Even if it wasn't a nugget that I really felt like I took.
I'm absolutely going to look up that particular episode. And yes, I have been doing some binging on your podcast and it's just been fantastic.
Well, so thank you for listening.
I've been absolutely taking notes and I'll be reaching out to some of the same guests at this point because it's like, dang, they ask great questions and that's fantastic. At this point, I'll be trying to snatch some of your guests as well.
Good. I mean, one of the fun things about it is it really is, in my small way, a way of elevating voices that I think warrant other people's attention. And yes, great. Plagiarism, highest form of flattery.
Excellent. Where's the best place for folks to engage with you, learn more about what you're excited about, or any other things you'd want to point them to?
Well, choosetobecurious.com is my website, and I'm at choosetobecurious on Facebook and Instagram, and I used to be on Twitter, but I couldn't take it anymore, so I'm on Threads, but not really because I haven't figured that out yet. So I would say the website is good. I mean, everything is there, and then that will send you lots of other directions. And be in touch. I mean, you know, I love hearing from people who have an idea about a curiosity conversation or who just want to engage with me on the subject. That's one of the real joys of the enterprise.
Beautiful. Well, we'll definitely tag all the different things that you mentioned in the show notes and make that available as well. So Lynn, thank you for joining us on this particular relaunch of Curated Questions. Indeed, you are the perfect partner to get things rolling here at the beginning of 2024. So I thank you so very much.
Well, thank you.
And for those who have joined us through the magic of technology, thank you for being here. Questions upended my life for the better. Lynn shared how curiosity has changed her life and increased meaning and joy. Questions encourage full participation and understanding of everything around us. please take all you have learned here and be a light to those around you. A shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for all the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. And as you transition into your next endeavor, please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.